Will Jenna's done anything at this stage? Although, if she's charged in the future, this is a potential contempt of court issue.
Can we find out who the author is?
Asked T.S. Martin.
Not easily, said Woodley. It's somebody calling themselves Lazy Donkey, but we've no way of knowing who they are.
We're monitoring closely for now, hoping things will calm down, said Fraser. I'll get legal eyes on it if it's still a problem in 24 hours. Right, anyone got anything to add? She looked around the room.
Excuse me, boss, Emma said. Her phone was vibrating. It's Rachel Jenner's home number.
Speak of the devil, said D.S. Martin. His fingers were working at a red lump on his neck.
Can I take it?
Emma asked Fraser.
Fraser gave her the nod.
Rachel. Nikki phoned the police, and then she and Laura scrubbed the fence. They wouldn't let me help them in case there were photographers, and I was in no state to anyway. While I sat on the sofa, cocooned in a blanket to try to stop my body shaking, they worked together in the cold to erase the evidence that somebody out there wanted everybody to think that I'd hurt my son. It was pointless, though. A Sisyphean task. Because while they scrubbed, fingers frozen and arms aching, we all knew that other people were at work elsewhere, spreading the message far more effectively and without getting their hands dirty. It was a very destructive effect, being publicly vilified or being aggressively targeted by others, however much you rationalize it and tell yourself that only the worst kinds of people do that sort of thing. I felt hemmed in by hatred, and I felt physically afraid. If somebody was brazen and motivated enough to graffiti that close to my property, what would stop them going further? Would they break in? Would they hurt me? Fear for Ben had inhabited every cell in my body since Sunday and governed my every thought and every action. But now, it was to be joined by something else. Fear for myself.
Jim. While Emma stepped out to take the call from Rachel Jenner, the rest of the team murmured quietly. The biscuit tin had been emptied, energy drinks were scattered around the table, and people were rubbing gritty eyes. Bennett tried to cover up a monstrously large yawn with his case papers. We were all battling our ebbing energy levels and trying not to be disheartened by lack of progress. Fraser summarized, "There's two trains of thought here, a twin-track approach, family or non-family. Now bear that in mind, please, everybody, as we go forward. The MOs are significantly different for each." She was interrupted by Emma returning.
That was the sister, Emma said. "They're frightened. There's been some abusive graffiti on the wall behind the house."
Fraser swallowed an expletive.
"That is not what we need," she said once she got her vocabulary under control.
"How's the mother?"
"She's very upset, apparently," said Emma, "as you would be, and frightened."
Fraser sighed.
"We should respond to that. The only problem is, if we station somebody at the house, we'll need one out front and one out back."
D.S. Martin shook his head.
"We can't commit budget to that at this stage. Once you've got protection there, how do you take it away? What if this lad isn't found? We need the threat to escalate to justify it."
Fraser made a note.
"I'll ask Uniform if they can drive by throughout the night, and check out the back alleyway too when they're there. It'll help if we're seen to take some action at least. The family need to know we're supporting them."
"Have they asked for protection?" Martin again.
"No," said Fraser. "But I think it pays to preempt these things. If we take it seriously now, we might head off a situation where they panic."
Martin nodded, approving.
Fraser's solution was neat and free.
I wondered if he actually kept the department budget spreadsheets constantly running across the front of his eyeballs.
"Did they see what the graffiti said?" Fraser asked.
"It says, Bad Mother," said Emma.
"Christ," said Fraser. "Well, I'm not surprised," said Emma.
Fraser's head snapped up.
"And what exactly do you mean by that?"
Emma flushed deeply. "Sorry, I only meant that I'm not surprised because there's been such a backlash against her. That's all, boss. I didn't mean to insinuate anything."
"Okay, then," said Fraser. "Glad to hear it."
She shot an assessing look at Emma before moving on, and I saw Bennett's fat lips form into a sneaky smirk, which I could have throttled him for.
"Which brings me to the next thing, because I think it would be wise to inform the family of this in person, too."
The next thing was a big disappointment to everybody. Forensics had reported that they'd found nothing of interest on the items of Ben's clothing that were discovered in the woods. Fraser felt it would be a good idea to send somebody to break the news to the family in person. With a glance at her watch, she sent Emma back out to Rachel Jenner's house. "Better go now before it gets too late. It won't do their nerves any good if we go banging on their door in the middle of the night. You can take a look at the graffiti, too, while you're there. Jim can update you on anything else we cover tonight." I nodded, kept my eyes on my own notepad. "And Emma," Fraser added.
"Yes, boss?"
"Keep up the good work. Your role is to observe, but also to support the family, so remember to be careful what you say."
"Got it, boss. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to..."
"I understand," Fraser cut her off. "Go on, get out of here now." As she left, I noticed that Emma's cheeks were still flushed. There wasn't much else. We discussed re-interviewing the parents, but decided to hold on that for a day. In spite of everything, Fraser was still working up a head of steam about Edward Fount. She wanted further background checks on him, and she ordered actions galore. Our team of DCs was tasked with talking to anyone that they could dig up who was associated with him. When all was done, Martin reared up out of his seat and gave us a short speech about teamwork and dedication, and how important this case was, and how the eyes of the nation were on us, and then put on his cap and left to attend the event for the great and the good at the Marriott. One by one, the team left the room, packing up papers wearily, some just moving a few yards to their desks, planning to burn the midnight oil. We were at that stage in a case where it's taken over. It's exhausting, it's addictive, and you can't get enough of it. Your nerves are frayed and you're running on adrenaline and caffeine. It's hard to do anything normal because the case is always in your thoughts. It's like a drug. Fraser and I were the last to leave. She looked tired and thoughtful. "You okay, boss?" I said.
"I'm okay," she said. "Go home, Jim. Get some sleep."
Rachel. Chang arrived after Nikki and Laura had come back in, knuckles red and swollen from scrubbing. She was there to break it to us gently that the forensic tests on Ben's clothing hadn't turned up anything. It meant that they couldn't get any specific leads from the clothing, she said, but they were still pursuing lots of interesting avenues.
"What are those?" asked Laura.
"I can't tell you any more than that, I'm afraid," Chang said. She took my hand. "But know that we're doing everything we possibly can. Don't lose heart."
She turned her attention to Laura.
"I heard today that you're a journalist."
"I am."
Laura wasn't afraid to look directly at her, but she twisted a bracelet on her wrist, a black silk band with a small jade rose on it.
"Why do you mention it?"
"I wondered if that puts you in a difficult position professionally, being at the heart of things here."
"I write gossip," said Laura. "Who turned out to the launch of a new lipstick at Harvey Nichols? That kind of thing. It's a different world."
"Oh," said Chang.
She paused before asking,
"Do you get lots of freebies?"
The tension in the room dissolved just a bit, and Laura softened.
"It's a perk, definitely. Though, I sometimes wonder what I'm going to do with 6 jars of black nail polish."
"Donate it to my daughters," said Nikki. "They seem to enjoy anything that's incredibly bad taste."
After that, the silence was a bit awkward. Chang started to excuse herself. She wanted to check the alley, but Nikki insisted that she have a cup of tea. Nikki was desperate to share the plans she was hatching.
"I think we need a vigil," she said. "If he's not found by next week. It's what they do in America. It keeps public awareness up."
Desperate not to leave any stone unturned, Nikki had been in email contact with somebody who worked for the Missing Kids website in the States, taking advice on what we could do. Chang took a sip of her tea. Her mug was one that Ben had decorated in one of those pottery places when he was very little. Covered in splotches of blue and different hues, it was apparently supposed to be a sea scene. He'd been very proud of it when he made it, although now that he was a bit older, he was embarrassed by it.
"It's babyish," he'd said the last time I used it. "I'm not putting it away, Ben," I replied.
I love it.
You can obviously do what you want, but I'd be very careful about a vigil, said Chang. The press can be a law unto themselves. You don't know how they'll react, and we mustn't compromise the investigation.
What would be very useful then, said Nikki, is if we could arrange a proper meeting with the police, with yourselves, to discuss some of these things together, agree on a proper course of action. We don't want to do anything that would affect the investigation, but there must be something we could do to help.
I'll ask, said Chang. I promise I'll ask. But be warned, everybody's already working all hours on the investigation. So manage your expectations, and for now, it's best to keep channeling your questions through me.
Before she left, she went out the back to see where the graffiti had been. She stood in the glare of my neighbor's security light and looked at the newly scrubbed fence, where the words had gone, but an orange wash remained. It struck me what a neat person she was. Alongside her warmth, she had a reserve about her and a sort of economy of both speech and dress that both impressed me and slightly intimidated me.
I'm going to check out the rest of the alley before I go, she said. We'll speak tomorrow.
In both directions, the alley stretched out into darkness. We could hear scuffling behind the fence as something took cover. Further away, the wind was making somebody's back gate creak and bang.
Go back inside, she said to me. Stay safe.
Jim, I did go home, but the flat felt hollow and cold, and I was unsettled. I called Emma. Where are you? I said when she answered. I'm in the alleyway behind Rachel Jenner's house. And? Well, they've washed most of the paint off, but you can see where the words were written in massive letters. How the family? Rachel's not good. She's really fearful. Looks ill, actually. Nikki's holding the fort. She's tough, that one. Proactive. I like her. And they've got Rachel's friend Laura with them. You going back in with them? I don't think I need to. They're coping for now. I'm cold, Jim. Need to get going. You coming round? I've got to go and see John Finch, tell him about the forensics. Afterwards? I'm so tired. I might just go to mine. Please, Em, I missed you last night. She didn't answer right away. The line went bad as the wind whistled into her handset, and it was hard to hear her when she said, Are you sure it's a good idea now I'm working for you? With me, not for me, and it doesn't have to make a difference. Of course it doesn't. Please, come round tonight. I'll come round after I've seen John Finch, but I'm warning you I won't be good for much. Are you okay? I hope I'm the right person for this job. Of course you are. Of course. Don't start getting wound up because of what you said at the meeting. Fraser knows you didn't mean it. The way she looked at me. Honestly, don't worry about it. Don't. She'd have forgotten about it by now, I promise you. You are the right person for this job. You're tired tonight. That's why it all feels bad. Just remember why you're doing it. It's for the boy. Emma? You there? Yeah, I heard you. It's for the boy. Are you coming round? I'll see you in about an hour. Don't wait up. After we spoke, I turned on all the lights in the flat and put the heating up. Then I went to the shop round the corner and got supplies for breakfast, and a Mars bar because Emma liked chocolate. I made a coffee and waited for her to arrive. I couldn't wait to see her, but I wanted her to be a normal self. I wanted her to tease me, take me out of myself, and make me forget work for a while. I wanted to hold her.
Rachel. When I got back inside, Nikki held the phone out to me.
It's John.
The nursing home rang, he said. My mother's distressed because you didn't bring Ben to visit her today.
Oh, God.
I'd forgotten about Ruth. Ben and I made a regular weekly visit to see her in her nursing home. Spending time with her grandson was one of the only things she looked forward to.
Does she know?
I asked.
No.
His voice was quiet.
I've asked them to keep her away from the media.
I knew it would be easy to keep Ruth away from the TV. She didn't have a television in her room, and she was fiercely dismissive of the communal areas of the nursing home,
keeping to her own room mostly. She loved to listen to Radio 3, though, and I wondered how they were managing that. She'd be desolate without it. John was one step ahead of me. He said,
"They've told her that her radio's broken, and Katrina dropped off some CDs for her and a player. It should keep her going for a while."
"You'll have to go and see her," I said.
"I can't see her."
This said so quietly that I could hardly hear him.
"Well, one of us has to go. We don't have to tell her."
I wanted it to be him that went. I didn't want to have to look into Ruth's eyes and lie to her about Ben. But to tell her would break her heart.
"No. Don't ask me to,"
he said.
"I can't."
"John."
"I'm sorry,"
he said, and he hung up. I stood there with the phone in my hand, incredulous.
"How does he think I can deal with this any better than him?"
I said.
"I'm not sure he's coping," said Nicky.
"Nobody's coping," I said.
"He's really on the edge."
"We're all on the edge." "Don't argue,"
Laura tried to be peacekeeper.
"I just don't see why everybody has to be so worried about John."
"We ought to be thinking of him," said Nicky. "It's not just you who's affected by this."
"Oh, and it's so hard for you with your perfect husband and perfect daughters safe in their perfect home,"
Nicky gasped.
"That's just not fair."
She got up and left the room. I'd gone too far.
"She didn't deserve that,"
said Laura.
"I know. She's trying to help."
I knew I should apologize to Nicky, but I couldn't bring myself to. She came back down soon afterwards, eyes red but face composed.
"Rachel, I know this feels unbearable, but we're all on your side, and there are even people out there who are on your side too. The stuff online, it's not all bad. People are out there searching for Ben. People we don't know."
"They're organizing themselves online," said Laura, "using social media."
"And the police are going to meet with us,"
said Nicky.
"Don't forget what Chang said earlier. We'll be working with them to find Ben. It'll give us the best chance."
She held my hand and squeezed it gently. But all I could think of was those people out there who hid behind online nicknames or anonymous blogs, or found safety in numbers on the payroll of newspapers. I thought about how they'd started hunting me from the moment I went off message at the press conference, and I felt preyed upon. Just like my son.
Jim. On the night of Wednesday, the 24th of October, after working all hours, basically until I was ready to drop, I dreamt of Emma, and I dreamt of Benedict Finch, too. I remember this because, in the moment before waking properly, when the dream was most intense, I clutched her, pulled her to me, and expected her to understand why. She'd been in the dream with me, after all. Instead, I scared her. She yelped and sat up, confused by being woken abruptly. "What?" she said. "What is it?" I realized my mistake then. Her voice, her actual real voice, chased the shadows of the dream away. "Sorry," I said. She relaxed, fell back onto the pillows, and looked at me with sleepy eyes. She said, "You look exhausted." And then, "What time is it?" I'd forgotten for a moment that dreams are private. The dream starts at Portishead Lido, where I'm meeting Emma for a coffee in the cafe. I sit down opposite her. We're the only customers. Across the room, amongst a host of empty tables, there's one that has a reserve sign on it. Outside, the water in the Bristol Channel looks grey and squally under clouds that are darkening, filthy and low. I feel as if we're in the last place on earth. I crave a cigarette. "I like it here," says Emma. "Really?" I say. I feel as if I'm in an Edward Hopper painting. She laughs. "Nighthawks, I know what you mean." "Or something like that," I say. I don't know what the painting is called, just that it shows a stark bar, only four people in it, muted colours, and a big dose of bleakness as its theme.
You don't like it? Says Emma. No, it's fine. It's nice. Emma starts talking fast. She's brimming with ideas that spill out of her and bounce off in different directions, as if you'd tipped out a basket of tennis balls, and suddenly they're bouncing everywhere at once, their individual trajectories too fast and too random to track. Her dark eyes flash and dart. Her skin is a soft, dusky brown. Her lips are full. In repose, her face is symmetrical, perfectly proportioned. When she's animated, she looks intelligent, intense, and engaging. When she smiles, it's surprisingly mischievous. As she talks, Emma disentangles the string of her teabag from the handle of her cup and dances the bag up and down. It releases dark curlicues of flavour that creep through the hot water and mesmerise me. I'm enjoying the moment, loving her company. But my cosy trance is broken abruptly by a silence that's weighted with suspense, like a breath held, because Emma's stopped talking, and she's fixated on the table that's on the other side of the cafe, the one that's reserved. Jim, she whispers. He's right under our noses. Look. I turn, and I see him too. Benedict Finch is sitting a few feet away from us, and I realize that the table was reserved for him. He's wearing his school uniform, just like in the photo we put up of him. He's a really beautiful child. I get up, but my motion is retarded, and I can't move towards him as quickly as I want to. The air around me is viscous and intolerably heavy. Where my bones should be, I feel only weakness, a confusing absence of strength. While I make only a few paces of progress, Benedict Finch stands up and peels off his school sweatshirt and top, and then his trousers, shoes and socks. He's wearing swimming trunks. He smiles at me and says, I'm going to take a dip. And still I can't move any faster. I haven't even covered half the ground between us. Benedict Finch strolls towards the doors that separate the cafe from the pool outside and disappears through the glass, ghost-like. I reach the doors just after him, but I'm trapped behind them. I hear Emma say, Jim, we've got to get him. I don't think he can swim. Outside, Benedict Finch is standing on top of a very high diving board. I don't know how he got there, because I can see that it's been cordoned off and the ladder's removed. I bang on the doors, I shake the handles, and I shout until I'm hoarse, but Benedict Finch, bold as brass, jumps. And it's then that I realize the worst thing of all, which is that there's no water in the pool. None at all. And I can't look. I pull Emma into my arms. Of course, then I wasn't dreaming any longer. I was awake, and I'd woken Emma up, and I had to say sorry, and I told it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and she should go back to sleep. She didn't, though. After a while, she said, Jim, are you awake? Yes. I'm bothered by Rachel Jenner. There's something about her. What do you mean? She's unstable. I know. Even her sister seems to treat her like she's made of china or something. What's your point? I don't trust her. Do you think she's harmed Ben? I don't know. It's just a feeling right now, but I think she could have done. Trust your instincts. Talk to Fraser about it, and keep your eyes peeled when you're with the family. If Rachel Jenner's done something, she might well let it slip. I am already. I will. I reached over and ran my hands up and down her arm, then let it rest on her skin, which was always perfectly soft. I felt myself getting drowsy, but after a while Emma got up. Where are you going? I asked, and she said, I can't sleep. I'm going to read for a bit next door. I'm fine. Go back to sleep. After she left, I was asleep again in moments, my hand resting on the warm spot on the bed where she'd been.
Day 5. Thursday, the 25th of October, 2012. You and law enforcement are partners in pursuit of a common goal, finding your lost or abducted child. And as partners, you need to establish a relationship that is based on mutual respect, trust, and honesty. When Your Child is Missing, a Family Survival Guide. Missing Kids USA Parental Guide, U.S. Department of Justice, OJJDP Report. Webpage, www.whereisbenedictfinch.wordpress.com. Where is Benedict Finch? For the curious, ... Food for thought. Posted at 0447 by Lazy Donkey on Thursday, the 25th of October, 2012. On Monday, the 22nd of October, police discovered a bag of clothing in Lee Woods near Bristol. They belonged to Benedict Finch. According to his mother, they were the clothes he was wearing when he disappeared. That's why police haven't issued a description of what he's wearing. Because they don't know. Because they've got to take the mother's word for it. Would you? Rachel. I slept the night in Ben's bed again, inhaling the perfect smell of him, worrying that it was fading away. I couldn't think of sleeping anywhere else. When I woke up, my body ached, crying out for proper sustenance, which it hadn't had for days. I could feel my hip bones protruding where they hadn't before, my stomach concave. My eyes drank in what they could in the dim light before dawn. I could see Ben's posters, his Doctor Who figurines, the silhouette of his piled-up boxes of Lego. I could just make out the dark stain on his carpet where he'd left a felt-tip pen with its lid off, and I remembered how cross I'd been with him when he did it. It had been our first week in the house, one of the first weeks in years when I'd had to wonder how I was going to pay for everything now that I wasn't cushioned by John's salary. I'd shouted at Ben, and he'd cried. Had he thought, I'd raged at him, how many hours somebody would have to work to pay for a carpet like that? Had he? Did he realize what life was like for most people? I'd been so angry. The memory was a sharp pain. It made me sit up and pull a cushion to myself, hunch over it and cry with great gulping sobs. It made me detest my previous self-absorption and shallowness. It made me wonder whether I'd been everything I could to Ben, especially in the past year. Whether I'd let him down terribly, filtering his needs through my own, letting my anger and depression seep between us where it shouldn't have been. I couldn't forgive myself. It was a noise from outside that got me out of Ben's bed to stand at the window. It was the creak of a fence, the thump of a landing. In my back garden was a man. He was standing in the shadows beside my studio, half concealed by shrubbery, but only half. He wore a dark coat and a beanie hat. A camera obscured his face, its long lens trained on the back windows of my house. Kitchen first, then a slow tilt up towards me. He was scavenging, like the fox. I stepped back, snapped Ben's bedroom curtain shut. From behind the curtain, I pounded on the window.
"Get out!"
I shouted.
"Go away!"
My sister ran into the room. She moved me aside and peered through the curtains to see the shadow of him disappearing over the fence into my neighbor's garden. The stairs rumbled as she rushed down and outside to confront him, but he'd gone. Out the front, the rest of the press pack feigned ignorance. As I watched, standing back from the window in my own bedroom, shaking from cold, Nikki went out into the street in her rosebud print nightie, hair greasy and wild nipples on show, goosebumps on her flesh, and told them what she thought of them.
"You are vandalizing our family!"
she shouted, and her words echoed up and down the quiet street, interrupted only by the mechanical dawn chorus of the camera motor drives.
Jim. Sometimes on a case, you get a bit of information that feels electric, like static under the skin, especially when it's very unexpected. I was awake before 6 a.m, feeling bruised from my dream at first, because it had lingered with me into the morning, and got mixed up with the tiredness I felt, and the disappointment that we weren't making as much progress as we'd have liked. But that didn't last long, because I checked my phone and saw an email that had just arrived very late the night before from one of the blokes we had digging up background on people. It was a new bit of information, and it changed what we knew about somebody close to Benedict, and to be sure that I acted on it properly, I knew I had to damp down my feeling of excitement and follow procedure. I had to make sure I did things right. So in order to do that, I had 4 conversations before I paid a visit to Rachel Jenner's house that morning. 6:15 a.m., Fraser. I paced around my bedroom, waiting for her to answer. She picked up quickly. Jim, she said, I'm hoping there's a good reason for this. You do know I bite the heads off orphans before I've had my first coffee. Nicola Forbes, I said. What of her? She hasn't been entirely honest with us. Understatement. I gave her a synopsis.
Okay, you got me interested. I'll see you in my office in an hour. If you don't mind, boss, I'll go and I'll talk to John Finch first.
Do you think you should talk to Rachel Jenner first?
My feeling is that she doesn't know about this.
Okay, keep me posted. 6:45 a.m. Emma. I was up and dressed by now, one espresso down, and the Bialetti foaming on the hob again already, because although I was more fired up than I had been for days, I'll admit I was feeling my lack of sleep just a touch, and I needed to drive that feeling back so I could stay on the ball completely. Emma was on the sofa, and groggy as hell, her forehead all scrunched up as she tried to fight her way back to consciousness from a deep sleep. I knelt down beside her, whispered that I'd made her a cup of coffee, and held it near her face so she could smell it. When she'd managed to open her eyes, I filled her in on what I'd learned. That woke her up properly, like a shot of adrenaline straight into the arm. 7 a.m. XDI Talbot. XDI Talbot was the man who'd sent me the information. Officially, he was retired, but now and then he came into work on cases as a civilian when extra bodies were needed. We always wanted him on a case because he was a proper bloodhound. He'd been digging into background on the individuals closest to Ben, and he'd stumbled on this information about Nicola Forbes. I wanted every detail from him. I wanted to hear it from him directly, to be sure I hadn't misinterpreted his email. 8:30 a.m. John Finch. The last was John Finch. When he opened the door to his house, he was in checked pajama bottoms and a crumpled T-shirt, a pair of reading glasses pushed up onto his head. His knees buckled, and I realized I should have called ahead. I'm sorry, sir, I said. There's no news on Benedict's whereabouts just yet, but if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to have a word with you about Nicola Forbes. He regained his composure impressively well. The man had nerves of steel. By the time his wife had reached the bottom of the stairs in the hallway behind him, wrapping a white dressing gown around herself, he had pulled the door open further and invited me in graciously.
Rachel. Nicky opened the door. It was mid-morning, and D.I. Clemmer was standing on the doorstep with Chang.
"Is there news?"
Nicky asked. It was all any of us ever seemed to say to each other. It was starting to sound pathetic to me, as if we would be punished just a little bit more each time we asked it, as if there were a vengeful god somewhere up there, counting each display of misplaced optimism. There wasn't any news. Clemmer said that they were here to have a chat, though something in his tone of voice suggested otherwise. It made me feel wary, but Nicky seemed oblivious to it.
"I could have used a little bit of notice," she said, "to get properly prepared for you, but I'm delighted you've made time to talk. We're so very grateful. We've got so much to ask."
She pulled some papers together and tapped at her laptop, looking for a document.
"Here it is," she said. "I've got a list here. It's roughly broken into two categories. Questions we have about the investigation and suggested actions to help in the search for Ben. Do you have a preference for which we should start with? And how would you like your tea? Or would you prefer coffee?"
I was watching Clemmo and Chang. He was waiting for Nicky to finish. Chang looked at her notebook, which she'd laid neatly on the table in front of her, then glanced sideways at Clemmo. Whatever they were here to say, he was going to be the one to say it, and I was becoming certain that it wasn't to discuss Nicky's wish list.
"Coffee, please,"
he said. Chang wanted some too. As Nicky filled a cafetiere with boiling water and set it down in front of us, Clemmo watched her in a way that made frost settle on my skin.
"From our point of view," she said, "this is so valuable. I've been doing some research, as you can see."
She smiled at them.
"And everywhere it says there's a much higher chance of success in finding the child if there's a close relationship between law enforcement and the family. So, thank you. So much. Help yourselves to milk and sugar."
She set down a sugar bowl and a small china jug. Steam rose from its contents. She'd warmed the milk. D.I. Clemmo opened his notebook and had a quick look inside it. He closed it again. Nicky finally heard the silence,
I'm so sorry, she said. I'm gabbling, aren't I? Sorry.
She pulled out a chair, sat down, and looked attentively at Clemo and Chang. Clemo cleared his throat before he spoke.
Do either of you know of a couple called Andrew and Naomi Bonus?
I shook my head.
No.
Nikki?
He asked my sister. Her face had emptied of colour instantly. It was extraordinary.
Oh, God, no,
she said, and the tendons on her neck appeared stretched and odd as she looked first at me and then back at Clemo, searching our faces for something. She stood up abruptly, but didn't seem to know what to do then.
This will be easier if you can sit down and talk it through with us,
said Clemo.
No,
said Nikki.
Don't do this.
Her hands were clasped together, the edges of her fingers white from the pressure of her grasp.
Please sit,
Clemo insisted. She didn't sit. She crumpled back into her chair as if he'd sunk his fist into her stomach.
What about their son, Charlie Bonus?
Asked Clemo, in a tone that seemed carefully controlled to sound light. He adjusted his chair, moving it just a little closer to Nikki. She wouldn't look at him.
Nikki?
He asked.
You know who they are, don't you?
You know I do,
she whispered.
And you?
He asked me.
Do you know?
I've never heard of them, I said. I was transfixed at the sight of my sister so vulnerable and defenseless. I was aware that I should probably move and go to her, but there was a ghastly momentum in the room now, and it felt unstoppable.
She doesn't know,
said my sister.
She hasn't got a clue, and that's the way it should be.
Hatred had crept into her voice, and it was directed at Clemo. He persisted.
And what about Alice and Katie Bonus? Do you know who they are?
Nikki began to shake her head violently.
Alice and Katie Bonus,
he repeated.
Do you know who they are?
He spoke slowly, giving each word space and a weight, as if it were a rock being dropped into water. She looked right at him, and it seemed to cost her an enormous effort to do that. Defiance and defeat waged war in her expression. She spoke her next words quietly.
I know who they are. Have you heard of them?
He asked me.
No,
I said.
Who the hell are they? Have they got Ben?
Are you sure you haven't heard of them?
No, she hasn't. She's telling the truth,
said my sister. Clemo remained impassive. He contemplated me, and then my sister in turn. I felt my chest tighten.
Will you tell her, or will I?
He said to Nikki.
You bastard.
Chang started to speak, but Clemo held a hand up to silence her.
Careful,
he said to Nikki.
You're frightening me, I said. I don't understand.
Nikki turned towards me. I was sitting at right angles to her, at the head of the table. She wanted to take my hand, and I let her.
Who are these people?
I said.
Andrew and Naomi Bonus,
said Nikki. It was hard for her to go on. A sob escaped her.
I'm sorry, Rachel,
she said. Her gaze flicked back to Clemo, and he nodded at her, willing her to continue. She placed one trembling hand upon the other, so that my hand was buried beneath both of hers. I saw in her eyes that some kind of battle was lost.
Rachel,
she said.
Andrew and Naomi Bonus are our parents.
Our mum and dad. What do you mean? No, they're not. That's not what our parents are called.
I tried to pull my hand away, but Nikki was gripping it now.
It is. Those are the real names of our parents,
my sister said. Her eyes were begging me to understand, but I didn't. Not really. Not yet.
And Charlie Bonus?
I said.
He...
She was welling up again, but she got herself under control.
He was our brother.
Brother? I'd never had a brother.
And the others? I suppose they're our sisters, are they?
Tell her everything,
said Clemmer. He'd broken Nikki, drained the fight out of her. In her expression, I saw terrible suffering, terrible vulnerability, and, most frightening of all, what looked like a plea for forgiveness.
Alice and Katie Bonus are us. Those were our names before they were changed. We were... We are... Alice and Katie Bonus.
Clemmo briskly pulled something from between the pages of his notebook. It was a newspaper cutting. If he hadn't showed it to me there and then, I'm not sure that I'd have believed any of them. I'd always been told that my parents died in a car accident. You could tell the story in an instant, and I'd been doing that for years. Our parents died in a head-on collision with a lorry. It had been nobody's fault, just a tragic accident. The steering on the lorry was proved to be faulty. My parents were cremated and their ashes scattered. There was no headstone. End of story. Except that apparently it wasn't. I wasn't who I thought I was, and nor was Nikki. Clemmo handed me a photocopy of a newspaper article from the 30th of March, 1982, 30 years ago. There was a photograph of a couple that I recognized as my parents. My Aunt Esther had had one photograph of them on her mantelpiece, and this grainy image showed the same two people. The difference was that in this image, they were with three children. I recognized my sister. She stood beside our mother. I could see a baby, a chubby little thing of about 1 year old in a smocked dress, and I supposed that she could be me. I didn't recognize the boy who sat in the middle of the picture. Around 4 years old, he was so like Ben it took my breath away. He had the same messy hair and balanced features, the same posture and the same grin, the one that could light up your day, and the same smattering of freckles across his nose. He was nestled between my parents. It was a lovely image, a perfect family. The headline beside it told another story. Batten disease family in fatal death leap. I scanned the article, snippets of it jumping out at me. Local couple Andrew and Naomi Bonus leapt to their deaths, driven to the act by lack of support for their terminally ill son. No grandparents surviving. Friends and neighbors expressed surprise. Had coped so well. Feel sorry for their two surviving daughters. Wanted to end his suffering. I looked at Nikki, who was watching me, stricken.
They killed themselves. And Charlie.
The way she said his name, the tenderness in those two words, the loss, told me that it was Charlie who she mourned above all.
But what about us?
Nikki looked away.
Why did they leave us?
Don't you think I've been asking myself that all my life?
And why didn't you tell me?
She didn't answer. I looked at the article again and stared at the photograph. Clemmo cleared his throat.
There was a report from the coroner. Would you like to know what it said?
I've read it, said Nicky. I want to know, I said.
He took another sheet of paper from his notebook, ran his eyes down it.
It says that your brother Charlie was diagnosed with Batten disease at the age of 5, and that his condition began to deteriorate rapidly after that. His diagnosis came a year after you were born, Rachel, at around the time that this picture was taken, but he was already experiencing some of the symptoms.
He looks okay in the photo, I said.
He did. He was lovely. Sunny-looking, vibrant, snug in his family's embrace.
He's not, said Nicky. He was beginning to lose his sight. Look at the photo. You'll see that he's not looking at the camera properly. He's looking above it. It's because he only had peripheral vision when that was taken. He had to look out of the bottom of his eye to see anything.
She was right. The little boy was staring at a point that was above the camera.
He was totally blind soon after that, Nicky said. And then he stopped being able to walk and stopped being able to talk. And he had to be fed with a tube because he couldn't swallow. And he had epileptic fits. The disease took him away from us piece by piece.
You loved him.
I worshipped him.
Her words seemed to hang for a moment between us, and when she spoke again it was hushed.
He didn't deserve it. I would have helped them. I would have helped them to look after him until the end. But they couldn't stand his suffering. Mum blamed herself.
Why?
It's an inherited condition.
But we don't have it.
I was struggling to understand.
Not every child gets it. It's a matter of luck.
So they jumped off a cliff with him. That's so extreme.
Nicky simply nodded. She turned her head away now, and I could only see her profile as she looked fixedly towards the dim winter light that filtered through the kitchen window, washing her features with grey.
But why would you do that if you had 2 other children?
I asked. Clemo replied.
The coroner's report does shed a bit of light on that. Apparently, because the condition was inheritable, they had had you tested. They were waiting for the results when they took their lives.
I'm fine, I said. Why didn't they wait for the results?
Your mother had convinced herself, and your father, that you would not be fine. By then she was, as far as we can gather, extremely depressed and unstable. She told her sister, your Aunt Esther, that she would not be able to cope any longer if you were also diagnosed with Batten disease, and your father had never coped well. The report mentions that she spoke of feeling very isolated. There was a stigma to mental and physical disability in those days, and your mother was not very emotionally strong. The coroner concluded that the strain of caring for Charlie had affected your parents profoundly. They felt that they had no option.
It makes no sense.
Things don't always make sense,
said Clemo,
especially when people are under duress. We see things you wouldn't believe.
I resented the way he was trying to reassure me, as if he hadn't just turned my world upside down, and I didn't want his words to distract me, because there was something else I needed to ask.
Why did our names get changed?
Nicky said,
Aunt Esther thought it would be better. She didn't want it to be hanging over us, or herself either. She thought people would judge us, that they'd say it was a shameful thing. Luckily for us, anyway, the Falklands War started 4 days later, so that article was all the press attention our little family story got. The papers were full of battleships and submarines after that. Better to be safe than sorry, though, Esther said, and social services approved the idea of having new names. I chose them, you know.
I renamed us.
She forced a sarcastic enthusiasm into her voice, but there was nothing in her expression to suggest that this fact actually gave her any pleasure. I picked up the article and studied the photograph. I'd never seen an image of myself as a baby before. I was chubby-faced, with a curl in my hair that I never knew I'd had. I was balanced on my father's knee, with fat little arms protruding from my dress. My hands were blurry, as though I might have been clapping. My sister stood beside my mother in the photograph. She wore shorts and a t-shirt, and her hand rested casually on my mother's shoulder. Her feet were bare, and she had the skinny, coltish legs of a prepubescent child. She was smiling widely. When I studied the faces of my parents, I felt a new emotion, a stab of betrayal. They'd been willing to leave me. Whether I was healthy or ill, they'd relinquished care of me at just 1 year old. They weren't taken from me by chance. They'd abandoned me, and they'd abandoned Nikki, too, in the most final way possible. I swallowed, and just that small physical reflex felt like an effort. I felt as if the blood had drained from me, just as it had from my sister minutes earlier, and with it, any strength that I might have had left, any fight. I was a husk, robbed of all the things that had made me who I am, all the things that had made me vital. "Am I Alice or Katie?" I asked. "Katie." It was a whisper, and Nikki's face contorted tearfully around it, mirroring mine. In the photo, my parents' expressions were impossible to read. They were both smiling for the camera, and I tried in vain to imagine what was actually going through their minds. I looked at my brother. He sat in the center, cocooned by their bodies. A terminally ill little boy who was never going to get to live a proper life. I wondered whether they had the diagnosis before this photograph was taken, or were they just worried about his eyesight at this stage? Thinking that was bad enough, and having no idea what horrors lay just around the corner for their little boy. A boy who looked just like Ben. I said to Clemo,
"Why are you telling me this now?"
He addressed Nikki.
"We spoke to your sister's ex-husband this morning."
She looked at him warily and raised her chin slightly, with a touch of defiance. She let go of my hand. The light in the room fluctuated, growing darker and more riddled with shadows as the clouds lowered outside.
"I know what you're going to say, and it's bullshit," she said.
"What makes you say that?"
"I know what you're trying to do, but you're wrong."
"What am I trying to do?"
"I don't have to listen to this."
"I think we both know that you do."
She crossed her arms, stared down at the table. I sat in a state of pure, simple shock. I knew well enough by now that you could lose your child in just a few minutes. But I was shocked into silence by the new knowledge that, in a similar space of time, you could also gain and lose a brother who was the image of that child, and parents who were more imperfect than any version of them that I'd ever imagined. Clemo spoke to Nikki.
"John Finch told us that when Ben was born, he was concerned that you might have what could be described as an unhealthy interest in Ben. Would you like to comment on that?"
"You revolting man," said my sister. "You haven't got a clue who's got Ben, so you've decided to pick on me. Easier to get someone close to home, is it? Stops you having to do so much work."
Clemo's gaze never left her face.
"Would you care to comment?"
he asked her.
"I'd be very interested to hear what your response might be."
"I'm sure you would," she replied.
"I expect your sister would as well," he said.
Nikki looked at me.
I've tried so hard and for so long to protect you. I just wanted you to have a life where you didn't feel rejected. I wanted it to be straightforward for you. But you were so...
She searched for a word, frustrated.
What? Difficult. And ungrateful. For what? Ungrateful for what? And irresponsible. You never understood anything. You just took it all for granted. You did what you wanted to do, when you wanted to do it. You had no burden. You had no loss to bear. I had the loss of my parents to bear.
I said this quietly, because I understood that she'd had more to cope with. But she was angry now, and so was I.
You were clueless, totally clueless. How could I have been any other way if you didn't tell me anything? That's not my fault.
She didn't respond to that. She had more to get off her chest.
You never thanked me. For what? For protecting you. How could I have known? They never thanked me either.
Suddenly she lost her momentum, as if that statement summed up the hopelessness of it all. Clemo leaned in towards her.
Who never thanked you?
Mum and Dad.
What did they never thank you for?
He asked.
For loving Charlie. For watching him when they'd had enough. For making him smile when they were too tired. When they couldn't cope any longer.
Her eyes were glassy with loss. His were intent.
Nicky, were you jealous when Rachel had Ben?
She snapped an answer at him as if he were running through a questionnaire.
Yes, I was jealous, yes. But you had the girls,
I said.
I wouldn't expect you to understand,
she said.
Why were you jealous?
Said Clemo.
Because he looked like Charlie, right from the start. All I could see when I looked at him was Charlie.
Did you feel that Rachel might not be able to care for Ben properly?
Said Clemo.
I was worried,
she said simply, and she turned to face me.
You were so feckless, you know. So young.
My sister spoke as if she'd rehearsed these words for years. Her speech gathered pace, as if she were confessing something.
You messed about for years. You never bothered with schoolwork, although they said you could have done brilliantly if you'd tried. You never cared about anything, and then all of a sudden you got John. God knows how, because you were pissing your life away, partying all the time, and suddenly everything was so perfect. And what had you done to deserve it? Nothing.
We fell in love, I said, but she took no notice. She couldn't seem to stop herself now.
I knew you'd have a boy the minute you told me you were pregnant. And when he was born and I went to see him and I held him, I saw Charlie in him. It was as if he was Charlie, reborn. He was so precious. And I wasn't sure you'd be able to look after him.
So you called John Finch,
said Clemo.
Just to check that she was coping, that she was doing the right thing.
Mr. Finch says that you were rather insistent with your phone calls.
Well, he wouldn't give me any information.
I interrupted them.
John never said anything to me.
They ignored me. Their eyes were locked. Nicky's gaze furious, his eyes hard like ice. Their terrible dialogue unpicking yet more of the stitches that had held my life together. I was relegated to the role of spectator.
Nicky,
he said,
did you want to have Ben for yourself, so you could look after him properly?
That's the thing, she said. I didn't. I didn't want her to have him, but I didn't want him either. He would have just reminded me every day what I'd lost, and that's why you're wrong.
Wrong about what?
For pity's sake!
She laughed. It was a shrill, upsetting sound.
Stop playing games with me! What would I do with him? Where do you think I would keep him?
I think you might like to have him. I think